Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce Elmer Brock, who is the chairman of the Committee on Foreign Affairs of the European Parliament. He's been a member of the European Parliament since 1980. He's one of the leading voices in Europe on foreign policy and has taken the lead, for example, on the Ukraine, and he will be presenting the award. Herr Brock.
Thank you very much for your introduction, ladies and gentlemen. We in the European Parliament have decided to give the Robert Schuman Medal to the President of the United States, George Bush, because of achievements for German unification and Europe's unity. Bismarck once has said, "You have to hear the code of history in the winds and to grip it, then you are a great statesman." And I think President Bush is one of these few people in history who had the ability to see what's going on and did that historical step, as not many people in history did. You have to be the right person on the right moment. And for us in Europe, he was the right man in the right moment. Without him, we would not have the success story we had. That we, as I myself started 1918 European Parliament, were 9 member states and have now 28 member states. Nobody of us thought in the 80s that one day we had a unified Europe with 28 nations living in the same economic order, under the same rule of law, with a common court and a common parliament. And this would not have been possible with the United States all up from 1945 on, but especially in their decisive moments, because of President Bush. I was asked by Chancellor Merkel to give her regards and wishes to President Bush and Barbara Bush. And also Helmut Kohl asked me to give a letter to him, and we'll read a few quotes out of that letter. He wrote, "In these days of memory, I remember once again with thanks our friendship and the cooperation full of confidence was decisive in these crucial days and months in 1890. On the 9th of November, I will think about you and your encounters and will bring out a toast on the German-American friendship since 1945, without which, this is my clear opinion, 1990, the German unification would not have happened. With all the best wishes for you and Barbara Bush, and God's blessing, yours, Helmut Kohl." And we believe that we keep this in memory, and we have heard today the news from Berlin that the name George Bush was mentioned so often in many speeches, in many articles. We Germans are aware that he was one of the decisive persons which made all the difference for our continent and for the global order. He was the right moment and the right man for such a moment, and therefore we want to thank him. This is a diploma I would like to give now to the President, which says that we in the European Parliament and especially European People's Party see that this is an homage to his actions and service for the question of peace and European unity and for the common values of mankind. Robert Schumann, the founder of European unification, and he has written short H.W. Bush, College Station, Texas, November 10th, 2004.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm Andrew Natsios, the director of the Scowcroft Institute, and it is my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker this evening. Jeff Engel is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, a senior fellow at the Norwegian Nobel Institute, and a graduate of Cornell University. He additionally studied at St. Catherine's College, Oxford University, and received his master's and PhD in American history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Later, he joined the faculty at the Bush School, and he has the important distinction of having been one of my predecessors as the director of the Scowcroft Institute. So we share many things in common, Jeff, but in particular, the burden of being the director of, it's not a burden, General Scowcroft, it's a great honor. Jeff Engel has written or edited 8 books on American foreign policy. I'm not going to go through all of them, but the most important thing and the reason we've asked him to speak this evening is he is now working on a book called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the Surprising Peaceful End of the Cold War. He's not quite finished, but he's close to it. We're all looking forward to that book, which will be a definitive work. Jeff?
Believe me when I say no one is looking forward to it being done more than I. Thank you, Andrew, for that wonderful introduction. Mr. President, Mrs. Bush, General Scowcroft, good to see you again. And Ryan, thank you for the hospitality. It is a great pleasure to be here. It is quite literally coming home. So thank you for making it such a warm homecoming, which makes me have to begin the speech in the appropriate way, which is to start off by saying, howdy. I missed that. Okay. So, let's begin. 25 years ago, the world changed. The impossible happened. Something wholly unexpected seized global attention, fundamentally altering a people, a continent, and the entire world system. Its consequences continue to reverberate to this day and are likely to ripple through time for centuries to come. Now, I speak, of course, of what happened on June 4th, 1989, the day that Polish voters ejected their communist government, which had ruled the country since its liberation from the Nazis. Reform candidates swept the nation's first free election in a wholesale rejection of 2 generations of communist rule. The regime was no more. Moscow's influence, and more importantly, the notion of a rock-solid Soviet bloc, was no more. And a homegrown democracy took its place. Now, perhaps this is not the momentous occasion from 25 years ago you thought I was referring to. Perhaps the Polish election is not the epic event of 1989 that you thought we were here to discuss. Well, no doubt then, when asked to consider 1989's most important moment, your mind instead goes to December 2nd, when Soviet and American officials met amidst raging seas at a summit billed as an end to the Cold War that raged, conveniently enough for headline writers, from Yalta to Malta. Or perhaps you think of May 2nd, when Hungarian officials first began dismantling their border with Austria, opening a window on the Iron Curtain that was never again shut. Or perhaps June 16th, again in Hungary, when thousands of those citizens gathered and the country literally stood still in order to bury their martyred leader from 1956. or perhaps September 11th, 1989, when officials in Budapest finally allowed East German refugees wholesale exodus into Austria and to freedom. More than 20,000 crossed in the first 24 hours, leaving friends, family, and most everything they owned behind. They even abandoned their sputtering Trabants, leaving the keys still in the ignition. Now, you have to remember that most people had waited years, sometimes even decades, for this people's car. But it was subsequently discarded, like life itself, behind the Iron Curtain. We gather tonight on the 25th anniversary of an event now 25 years in the past, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it has been a day of enlightening presentations. We heard over lunch from two men who helped guide US foreign policy during this tumultuous period. And we have discussed what it meant that a wall fell in Berlin, that an empire in turn fell in its wake, and that the world in a real sense turned a final page on the long and bloody 20th century. And yet as we gather here tonight in the shadow of the Bush Presidential Library, and of course in the presence of President Bush himself, in order to consider these events in their fullest historical context, my first point is a reminder that Berlin is not the whole story. Now, it was undoubtedly important. The wall divided a people, effectively jailing an entire nation. 136 people died trying to scale it. Hundreds more were injured, and thousands more than that jailed. But the wall symbolized something more as well. It symbolized a divided Europe, a struggle between East and West, competition between democracy and capitalism, between capitalism and socialism. Berlin was a city whose fate had repeatedly nearly brought the world to the brink of atomic destruction. In short, therefore, Berlin mattered politically, strategically, even culturally. But its fall in November of 1989, however unexpected, was also but one peak on the interconnected waves of change that swept the world during that most tumultuous of years. Any number of European events, be they elections, funerals, openings, or summits, could stake an equal claim to similar significance, to being the moment when the Cold War that had gripped humanity for a half century ended. Or perhaps, when asked to consider the most important event from 1989, what mattered most for global history, which events from that year are likely to reverberate longest through time, you think instead of Tiananmen Square and what occurred within the beating heart of the world's most populous country. Now, truth be told, that would get my vote. On the very same day that Poles stood up at the ballot box, China's growing reform movement was mowed down. Crowds exceeding 1 million people. Now, just stop and think about what a crowd the size of a million people looks like. They shouted for change, they shouted for reform, and they shouted for an end to government corruption. Now, needless to say, their government saw things differently. As Deng Xiaoping, China's erstwhile leader, coldly stated, quote, "We must deal severely with those who defy orders," end quote. China, of course, has not been the same since. Not since the night that transformed Tiananmen from a place into an event. When Deng's tanks toppled the Goddess of Liberty, Chinese Communist Party effectively cut a deal with its own people, guaranteeing economic growth in exchange for stifled political liberalization. The free market, if you will, without the freedom. And Chinese leaders live today in awful fear of what might happen if they fail to supply the prosperity that is their half of the bargain, even as they strive to erase June 4th from national consciousness. Just try typing the digits 6489 into a search engine while in China, and note how quickly you hear a knock on the door. And yet, China's people remember. Protesters gathered just in recent weeks in Hong Kong, many not yet born in 1989. They rally with the thought of Tiananmen on their lips, yet importantly, they also have the specter of Tiananmen causing them to look forever over their shoulders. Now, perhaps Asia is not actually your cup of tea. Perhaps you prefer your history more hegemonic, more colonial, more, shall we say, Eurocentric. If you insist upon finding 1989's most historic event and most important moment in Europe, then perhaps it's best to focus on Mikhail Gorbachev, father of perestroika, and a moment from his quest to save the socialist system that he loved through a revolution of ideas. Inarguably one of the 20th century's most influential figures, he was, more to the point, one of the century's most important reformers as well. Now, ironically, the same might well have been said about Deng Xiaoping. But for the moment, let's keep focused on the Soviet leader. Gorbachev promised to and vowed to reform a sclerotic Soviet state before it was too late. As he told his wife the very night that he was brought to power in 1985, quote, "We can't go on living like this. The system was dying away. Its sluggish, senile blood no longer contained any vital juices," end quote. And as he and Ryza walked in a cool night in 1985, the newly installed leader of the world's most second powerful country cleared his head for the political struggle to come. They were walking and talking outside, it should be noted, and therefore beyond range of eavesdroppers by potential political opponents who were ever lurking throughout his entire time in office. Gorbachev would ultimately go even further than merely changing his state, offering instead a full reboot of the entire international system that he believed had gone awry. For Gorbachev, you see, was at his heart that most unusual of leaders. He was an intellectual, enthralled by ideas and less interested in the day-to-day affairs of government than in its underlying philosophy. Think back, if you will, to 1986, about a year after he took office, when the full implications of perestroika first began to penetrate the minds of most senior Soviet officials. As the conservative head of the Communist Party's International Department screamed at Gorbachev during one debate inside the Politburo, quote, "What is this new thinking? Our thinking is already correct. Marxist-Leninism is already correct. Let the Americans change their thinking," end quote. But change was Gorbachev's point. He did not know where perestroika would lead. But knowing that they could not go on living like this, he knew he was willing to try. In fact, let me read you a way that he described a retreat with his inner circle from that same period. Quote, "We really quarreled. For a day and a half, we stopped speaking to each other. And what was the argument about? About the fact that we live in an interdependent, contradictory, but ultimately integral world. No, the new thinking wasn't just some policy shift. It required a major conceptual breakthrough," end quote. Now, equally unusual for an intellectual, Gorbachev was also an optimist, a trait that stood in stark contrast to most geopolitical strategists, including the hardcore skeptical realists who directed the newly inaugurated Bush administration in 1989. Others could afford the luxury of being fashionably optimistic. National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, general, reasoned. To his way of thinking, caution never went out of style, a way of viewing the world best embodied by one of Scowcroft's frequent reminders that, quote, "One must never forget that the light at the end of the tunnel may well be an oncoming train." The Americans, of course, had plenty to be skeptical about, for Gorbachev not only vowed to change socialism, but in time he believed it within his power to change the entire world. His vision for a common European home, fully fleshed out in 1989, and thus a pretty darn good candidate for being the most momentous event of that year, was offered a bridge between East and West built on foundations of peace, prosperity, and human possibility. The common European home would transcend Cold War divisions, ridding Europe of the scourge of conflict, while simultaneously fusing the productivity of capitalism without losing what he considered the humanity of socialism. And it was, quite simply, the single most articulate and profound sentiment and statement of a new world order since Woodrow Wilson, further cementing Gorbachev's position as the world's most popular man, at least outside the Soviet Union. As the New York Times famously editorialized, quote, "Imagine that an alien spaceship approached Earth and sent the message, take me to your leader. Who would that be? Without doubt, Mikhail Gorbachev." End quote. Now, stop and consider that quote for a moment. Gorbachev, the world's leader. Gorbachev, whose country was in decline, whose economy was in shambles, where life expectancy dropped and rates of infant mortality and alcoholism rose. Gorbachev, a man so convinced of his country's dismal future that he ripped out its own fundamental ideological roots. Gorbachev, leader of what Secretary of State James Baker once sarcastically, though I think not inaccurately, termed Upper Volta with missiles. He was the world's leader. No wonder, therefore, that George Bush, as President of the United States, the man that was supposed to be the most important and powerful person in the world, no wonder he, quite frankly, feared Gorbachev in 1989, doubting his motives, doubting his game plan, and ultimately doubting Gorbachev's basic sincerity. Asked in late 1988 if he thought that perestroika was for real, as both Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher did, Bush declared, quote, "The jury's still out." Now that may not seem like a particularly harsh condemnation, but you must remember that this was a truly startling statement for Bush, who as vice president never once spoke out publicly against Ronald Reagan, not once. His sense of loyalty demanded as much. His refusal to join Reagan in backing Gorbachev thus spoke volumes, revealing his deep sense of skepticism for claims that perhaps the Cold War might truly be entering its end game. And Bush, of course, was not alone in his skepticism. In Scowcroft's view, importantly shared enough by Deputy National Security Advisor Bob Gates, Gorbachev's hopeful words disguised and hid a brilliantly Machiavellian plan to rip Cold War victory from the jaws of imminent defeat. Perestroika, you have to understand, in their minds was a ruse. Glasnost, a disguise in the common European home, designed, Scowcroft said, quote, "to divide NATO through a peace offensive rather than to bluster the way some of his predecessors have," end quote. It was time to look at the Soviets through more realistic eyes, derisively noting, Scowcroft said, that leading from the Reagan administration to the Bush administration, it was, and I have to say this is my favorite quote from the entire book, "it was time for the adults to be back in charge," end quote. Thank you for that. And in fact, ultimately, General Scowcroft said in his very first interview as National Security Advisor in 1989, quote, "the Cold War is not over," end quote. Now, more than skepticism about Gorbachev was at play here. Rather, the quote reveals a strategic fundamental problem and discussion that infused Bush's entire time in office. Consider, if you will, a meeting from Kennebunkport in July of 1990. Now, note the date. July of 1990, a full 8 months after the Berlin Wall was down, after the bulk of negotiations over German unification were completed, after free elections behind the Iron Curtain, and after truly unprecedented changes throughout the Soviet bloc. Even after all this, George Bush would still not publicly acknowledge the Cold War's demise. Instead, he looked around the table, looked into the eyes of each of his principal advisors, and forbade them from uttering the magic phrase, "the Cold War was over." Now why? Why did he hesitate to declare victory? Well, two reasons predominate, I think. One strategic and the other more revealing of his diplomatic style. The strategic reason for why Bush refused to declare the Cold War over until long after the Berlin Wall was really critical to understanding his entire overall foreign policy agenda. For he could not publicly state it was over because in 1988, in 1989, or throughout the bulk of 1990, he did not know the answer to the next obvious and fundamental question. What would take its place? And until he knew what a post-Cold War Europe in particular would look like, until he knew for certain that Gorbachev could survive the growing communist counter-revolution that forever seemed to be in the offing, until Bush knew for certain that a new wave of isolationism would not erode the forward deployment of American troops that he considered necessary for global security, ultimately, until he knew that the revolutions of 1988 would not only prove peaceful, but good, Bush was loath to claim the Cold War truly over. Now, I have to say, he grew tired of being asked. exhausted after meeting Gorbachev, after their meeting in Malta in late 1989, for example, Bush, in fact, lashed out in frustration at a reporter's query. Quote, "Is the Cold War the same? I mean, is it raging like before in the times of the Berlin blockade?" Parenthetically, note Berlin. "Absolutely not. Things have moved dramatically. But if I signal to you there's no Cold War, then it's what are you doing with troops in Europe? I mean, come on," end quote. By the way, the record actually has the come on. Bush's mention of troops in Europe was no accident, as he believed one thing more than any other, that any post-Cold War settlement to survive over time required American leadership. Twice, Europe had gone to war in the 20th century, of course, innumerable times before that. But not, he and his staff reasoned, had they done so since 1945. Not, that is, since the Americans came, but did not leave. And he was determined, above all else, to ensure continuation of the policy he considered the very bedrock of global security. And this determination, I think, explains, by the way, his entire approach to German unification, which Bush endorsed ultimately only so long as a united Germany remained wholly embedded within NATO. After all, one must reason that NATO could not possibly have survived long without Germany. And without NATO, then what formal reason do the Americans actually have for remaining in Europe? And evidence for Bush's conviction of this abound in the archival record. Now, my favorite, actually, comes from a speech that the president never, in fact, gave, but one that he intended to. His planned remarks, which were instead hastily rewritten after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Now, what Bush planned to say in Aspen in early August of 1990 was instead to have been a full declaration of Washington's intention to stay put no matter what changing geopolitical winds might bring. "We will remain in Europe," he planned to say, "to deter any new dangers, to be a force for stability, and to reassure all of Europe, East and West, that the European balance will remain secure," end quote. And Bush's sense that the world required a full American engagement reveals, I think, much about his diplomatic style as well, but I'll return to that in a moment. Because if we're truly to understand the fall of the Berlin Wall in its fullest global context, indeed, if we're truly to continue on this quest to find 1989's most meaningful moment, there's one more thing to say about Gorbachev. Gorbachev's speeches grabbed headlines, as we've already seen. But much like Bush's speech, Never Given, his most important statement from 1989 was never uttered before a cheering crowd. It was instead his quiet message to Eastern Europe's socialist stalwarts, given behind closed doors, that he would not support their use of force in quelling their own crowds of protesters who increasingly spilled into the streets as 1989 progressed. He would not back them if they used force to save their skin, as Deng Xiaoping's regime had done. Indeed, 1989 is most often thought of as a year when so much happened, a revolutionary year, perhaps unlike any other. Looking back, however, I contend it was what did not happen, the decisions not made, or rather the moments when leaders made the conscious decision not to act, that made all the difference. Now, most of the world has, which includes most of us in this room, after 25 years, blissfully forgotten just how dangerous the end of the Cold War was, how chaos loomed with the disintegration of the Soviet Empire, potentially unleashing pent-up ethnic, racial, and historic antagonisms, all in the context of a nuclear-armed military juggernaut coming apart at the seams. And Bob Gates, armed, of course, with his PhD in history, repeatedly warned any and all who would listen, whether they were listening or not, he would tell them, that never before in human history had a major empire collapse without an ensuing great power conflict. Never before in human history had violence not filled a power vacuum. Revolutions frequently start out joyfully, Gates argued, before exacting their price. And 1989 held all the makings of a costly year. It's a year most often recalled, at least in the context of Europe, as a year story of crowds. Crowds gathered in Warsaw, in Budapest, in Berlin, and Leipzig, demanding change, demanding accountability, demanding freedom. In country after country, this widely accepted narrative explains, crowds marched and the regimes fell. And this version of history has a very nice warm feel to it. It gives the crowd agency. It gives democracy real force. It makes us feel individually powerful, as though each of us might somehow contribute to changing the course of history. And people just love this version of why communism fell. As historian Will Hitchcock nicely summed up this strain of thinking, quote, Gorbachev did not give Eastern Europeans their freedom in 1989. They took it, end quote. Now, this is a nice warm version of events, yet it's also incomplete. Now, crowds matter. People matter, don't get me wrong. But their success or failure ultimately rested in the hands of others. Fed up by decades of repression, Eastern Europe's crowds marched. But in doing so, they actually returned the power of events back into the hands of the very leaders they despise, the leaders who had one more fateful decision to make in response, to fire or to topple, to douse the flames as Deng Xiaoping had, or to hope that they might burn out. And of course, none could say for certain if their buckets ultimately held water or gasoline. Now, thankfully, of course, Eastern Europe's leaders chose the more peaceful path. Tiananmen did not happen in Warsaw, in Dresden, in Leipzig, or in Berlin. Looking back at 1989 and asking what it all meant, it seems clear to me then that Gorbachev's greatest achievement was not a stirring speech. It was instead when he told Eastern Europe's troglodytes that this would not be 1953, it would not be 1956, it would not be 1968. This time, there would be no Soviet crackdown. More to the point, this time, there would be no safe haven should the region's leaders fail to keep order peacefully on their own. For Gorbachev, you have to understand, abhorred violence. Becoming physically ill in April of 1989, when Soviet police violently dispersed Georgian protesters, 20 people died, and the moment terrified him. Why? Because he did not order the crackdown. He, the most powerful man of the Soviet Union, he, the world's hero, he, the new Prometheus of change, had less power when crowds and police clashed than the lowliest soldier, scared, though armed with a gun, or the least subdued protester, armed with a rock. Either of these could spark a melee that might spin quickly out of control. Either could start the chaos that might ultimately consume the world. Gorbachev, therefore, feared crowds way too much to crack down, fearing as well the opportunity that violence might provide for his conservative opponents to crack down even harder on his reforms. Now, turning one last time, well, not one last time, one more time, to China, Deng and his generation of Chinese leaders feared crowds so much that they did, of course, crack down. They, you see, remembered all too well the pain of the Cultural Revolution, when screaming crowds roamed China's streets, tearing down anything that reeked of authority, of order, of the old way of doing anything. Deng himself, we should remember, was exiled to the hinterland. Perhaps more personally painful, his son, thrown from a Beijing rooftop by zealous Red Guards. Some say the young man jumped to elude their grasp, but either way, he remained paralyzed until the end of his days. Deng therefore knew, and knew firsthand, what to do when crowds gathered and refused to be dismissed. As he told the inner circle of leaders in China, quote, "We can afford to shed some blood, just try as much as possible not to kill everyone," end quote. Now, of course, nothing like Tiananmen happened in Europe, though I should add, not by accident. Nothing happened because leaders, East and West, worked hard to keep chaos at bay, conflict at a minimum, and violent repression more a fear than a reality. We must never forget that all that happened in Europe in the fall of 1989 happened after Tiananmen Square, and that global leaders of the time drew a direct and worrisome line between the two. Take President Bush, for example, who confided in his diary only days before, and thank you for keeping a diary, only days before the wall, that, quote, If we mishandle this change in Eastern Europe and get way out in front looking like an American project, you would invite crackdown and invite negative reaction that could result in bloodshed," end quote. The times were too dangerous for grandstanding or dramatic gestures, he argued. Vocal support of democratic regimes might actually catalyze revolution or perhaps catalyze a violent government reply. He would indeed do more good, Bush reasoned, by working behind the scenes, calling fellow leaders, urging calm, ultimately saying as little as possible in public. And critics, of course, railed at his silence, accusing him of being unconcerned, accusing him of being out of touch, accusing him of being downright unaware of historic events taking place overseas. In fact, let me briefly remind you of an oft-told story, including one that General Scowcroft told at lunch today, but a story that I think this evening bears repeating nonetheless. It is the story of President Bush's reaction as he watched in real time, just as the rest of the world did, as Berliners danced and cried and dismantled the despised concrete and barbed wire that had once divided them. His press secretary came to him, Marlon Fitzwater, and implored, "Mr. President, you have to make a statement. People are expecting you to say something." Now, President Bush at first demurred, saying, quote, "I don't want to give a press conference because we don't know what's going on," end quote. But he ultimately conceded, inviting reporters into the office where he and General Scowcroft sat watching events in Berlin unfold on a small television set in the corner. Leaned back in his chair, the president answered questions calmly, too calmly for some. For after a while, you see, CBS's Leslie Stahl finally asked what was in the minds of many in the White House press corps. Quote, "This is sort of a great victory for our side in the big East-West battle," she said, "but you don't seem elated." Bush simply shrugged and said, quote, "I'm just not an emotional kind of guy," end quote. Now, Stahl was not done. She asked, after a moment's pause, "Well, Mr. President, quote, how elated are you?" And Bush said the following, quote, "I'm very pleased. And I've been very pleased with a lot of other developments. And so the fact that I'm not bubbling over, well, maybe it's just getting along toward evening." Now, this was not the reaction that many in Washington desired. Many wanted him to celebrate, to declare victory, to pound the nation's chest in victory in a manner he derisively called dancing on the wall. But Bush, you see, would not, because he had Tiananmen in mind. He had Gorbachev in mind. And he knew one vital thing. For all the enthusiasm of the crowds, conservatives retained all the power. The crowd, you see, had the initiative, but the troglodytes retained the guns. And we now know what a near-run thing East Germany's collapse really was, and how in turn we all were so very lucky. We now know, in fact, that East Germany's governments actually gave the order to fire on protesters in Leipzig mere weeks before the wall fell. Just as we also know that the wall itself was opened in large measure by accident, by a misunderstanding of a government announcement of relaxed travel restrictions. Now, in both cases, botched communications left commanders on the ground in the lurch. In Leipzig, you see, police refused to pull the trigger until they received but one more confirmation from the party's central command. They called, but no one picked up the phone. And in Berlin, guards at the wall similarly called for instructions when crowds gathered. And hearing no useful answer, in fact being derided by their superiors for even asking, they had a fateful decision to make: to follow their standing orders and to fire, or to step aside. Once more, of course, it was the action not taken, the command not followed, the poke in the eye of communist hardliners not given that made all the difference. And this is why 1989 truly happened as it did, why chaos was avoided and war, I argue, precluded. Not because necessarily of what people did, but because at the fateful moment when emotions flowed hottest and the stakes seemed highest, individuals from the bottom of the top were strong enough to do nothing. It was, for Bush, the embodiment of what I like to call his Hippocratic diplomacy. The determination to first do no harm, even if it meant doing nothing in the public eye. And therefore, now we get to the real heart of the matter and the soul of President Bush's successful diplomacy. An answer, therefore, to the vital question of why. Why did President Bush feel comfortable doing less and saying nothing, even at great political cost? Now, two reasons, it seems to me, stand out. One is personal, and the other is philosophical. Now, in terms of personal, Bush simply refused to let the potential of short-term political gain, or conversely, the pain of political criticism, he did refuse to let either of these goad him into making decisions that he thought strategically ill-advised. And this, simply put, was prudent leadership on display. Now, on a more philosophical level, President Bush fundamentally believed that action carried more risk than potential gain because his side was already winning. History, you see, flowed in Washington's direction, Bush believed. It flowed in democracy's direction as the 20th century came to an end. And history would continue to flow in that positive direction. It would flow towards a direction more democratic and more free, and it would continue to expand at its own natural pace so long as nothing radically happened to change its course. As Bush explained to his diary, once more, in the fall of 1989, quote, "Critics say we're not doing enough on Eastern Europe. Here the changes are dramatically coming our way, and if any one event, Poland, Hungary, or East Germany had taken place, people would say, this is great. But it's all moving fast. It's all moving our way," end quote. Now, of course, we all know that East Germany's government looked into the abyss in late 1989, and it blinked. And East Germany was, amazingly enough, gone within a year. The Soviet Union, of course, soon followed it into the grave. China's ruling communist regime remains, offering, I think, the stark and somewhat troubling lesson from 1989 that those who chose the path of peace and reform, or at least surrender, saw their states toppled. The regime that sent in the tanks is still here. Now, what then is the ultimate lesson of 1989? Now, I'm forever wary as a professional historian of drawing ironclad lessons from history, because if we ever did determine an ironclad lesson from history, I'd be out of a job. And I dare not leave you with the notion that violence works. But by way of concluding my remarks tonight, I think if there is but one lesson to take from 1989, beyond my central point that it's an intertwined global affair, I think it is that where one stands on the long-term legacy of 1989 depends in large measure upon where one sits, or more accurately, where one lives. Indeed, four distinct interpretations and answers of 1989 dominate to the question of why the wall fell and in turn why communism collapsed, dominating discourse in four powerful corners of the world: the United States, Europe, Russia, and China. Now, this is no mere academic debate, for how political elites understand the past directly affects their strategies for the future. Now, several of my previous speakers today have already touched on these points, but let me briefly sketch out these four dominant narratives as a way of concluding my look at the Berlin Wall's legacy. Americans, by and large, understood the end of the Cold War as a story of triumph. As George Bush declared, "By the grace of God, America won," end quote. And he was finally willing to say so by 1992. 40 plus years of economic and military dominance won, to be specific. Soviet surrender, when coupled with a democratic eruption in Eastern Europe, symbolized to American minds acceptance not just of US global dominance, but more importantly, acceptance of American values, offering a profoundly simple yet profoundly powerful explanation for the Cold War's end. Might makes right, and we were right all along. Now, like all dominant historical narratives, which I like to call society's meta-narrative, if you will, which means the useful stories it tells itself about the past, this one's accuracy matters less than its popularity, especially when one uses it as a recipe for future success. The lesson from this history is, so long as the United States remains strong enough to withstand any force, and as long as it holds fast to American ideals, the world will eventually fall in line. As Bill Clinton explained, quote, If the wars of the 20th century have taught us anything, it is that we achieve our aims by defending our values and leading the forces of freedom, end quote. And such triumphalism dominated American thinking over the last 25 years, no matter who held the White House. As George W. Bush declared in 2003, the toppling of Saddam Hussein's statue in Baghdad will be recorded along the fall of the Berlin Wall as one of the great moments in the history of liberty, end quote. And 5 years after that, Barack Obama situated his international coming out party in Berlin. In the midst of a global financial crisis and of international critique, the site, it seems, offered reminder that the American system had once worked. As Obama preached, quote, let us remember this history and answer our destiny and remake the world once again, end quote. That's the American story. Now, Europeans don't buy it. The prevailing explanation for communism's collapse in Europe gives credit not to American might and ideals, but rather to their own continental elan. Force, you see, had not destroyed communism, rather the absence of force had. The absence of force, you see, made the Velvet Revolutions possible, for by avoiding war for more than two generations, sage European strategists in this history gave communists time to come to their senses. And peace, of course, was no accident in this European narrative, but it was instead derived from transnational institutions and integration designed specifically to heal the bloody divisions of the past. For you see, European society had nearly committed suicide in World War I. It tried and nearly succeeded, again, in World War II. But no one, I mean no one, thought it would survive a third try in the atomic age. Post-1945 leaders, therefore, decided to try something different. They forged a common home, melding divergent economies, religions, cultures, and nations into a society in which even the threat of force had no place. And by the close of the 1980s, victory seemed at hand. As the president of the European Commission explained, quote, the watchword of the post-1945 politics, we must never go to war with each other again, buoyed the hopes of those who built the European community, and that objective has been achieved. End quote. Now, stop and consider that for a moment. That the objective was never to go to war again, and as he said, that objective has been achieved. Europe, in other words, had vanquished war, solving not only a fundamental aspect of its own history, but of course, of the human condition itself. Now, the hubris underlying this conclusion exceeds even the belief that people all over the world desire to be American. Yet this narrative explains not only Europe's success, but communism's failure. When Gorbachev, you see, in this narrative, spoke of a common European home, he was expressing less a desire to control Europe than to marry it, and a willingness to forsake even socialism in order to fuse East and West. Europe's meta-narrative, of course, offers policy prescriptions as well, just as the continent's ongoing fascination with consensus reveals in large measure why its leaders have been so critical of aggressive U.S. policies over the past decades. Force, they argue, is inherently destructive, and at best, a temporary fix. The lesson is this for them. So long as we don't force others to see the virtues of our society, one-time enemies will eventually tear down their own walls in order to join us. Now, Russians typically draw more bitter lessons from 1989. Gorbachev's hopes for future integration with Europe were soon dashed. NATO expanded despite what Moscow at least took to be an explicit promise that it would be held at a newly unified Germany's eastern border. The European Union ultimately barred its doors. Poles, Czechs, Slovaks, and Hungarians, liberated from Nazi tyranny and supported by the Kremlin for decades at great cost, turned westward without even looking back. And most significant of all, there was no Marshall Plan. This time, Russian nationalists claim, the victors merely left their enemies to rot. For you see, the post-Soviet economy collapsed. Food supplies plummeted. Life expectancy declined even further, while alcoholism and infant mortality rates both rose dramatically. Perhaps worse yet, humiliation followed hunger. As Russians saw the United States flex its military muscle around the world, even as their own interventions in their strategic backyard produce Western scorn. This is the Russian version of events. Vladimir Putin, in particular, views 1989 in tragic terms. Soviet collapse, he has concluded, was, quote, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century, end quote. And his lesson? That Western promises are worthless. Russia, he argues, is only respected when feared. Now, of course, he dares not compete with the United States militarily. He's not that foolish. But he instead finds common cause with other states that considers America both arrogant and hegemonic, while employing the tools at his disposal, including vast energy resources, cyber prowess, and a Security Council veto, in pursuit of narrow nationalistic interests. Let the Americans bluster. Let the Europeans talk, Putin reasons. He acts. Now finally, China's legacy is the most inwardly focused of the four. This legacy of 1989 is one I've already mentioned, that repression works so long as leaders are tough enough to crack down and crack down hard, and so long as the people remain fat and satisfied. Each of these four great powers, therefore, barrels ahead, guided by its own version of the past, running full bore into the future on roads of their own making. Yet, consider any intersection where every light flashes green. Crashes are inevitable. Europe remains committed to collectivism, standing up to geopolitical bullies with only the greatest reluctance. The United States remains committed to fielding the world's most powerful military, even at the cost of its economic base and the educational system that in large part generated such power in the first place. Russians are consuming their neighbors as though striving to win the 19th century, no matter the sanctions or cost. And the Chinese continue to crush dissent, even as they manipulate their yuan and strive for full employment, waving the bloody shirt of nationalism whenever domestic support seems to sway. Collisions are only a matter of time when conflicting lessons of history prevail. Anxious Americans might trigger a new arms race with China. After all, the strategy worked with the Soviets. Europeans might put such faith in conciliation that they fail to see a true threat at their door. You have to see they've done so before. Putin and his successors might one day step too far, triggering real conflict while exacerbating domestic unrest by trading the remnants of prosperity for old-fashioned hard power. And mobs, of course, already gather in Hong Kong and might yet roil the mainland if growth declines and the internet's reach expands. Ultimately, and in conclusion, it pains me to say, the lessons of 1989 and of the Berlin Wall are not wholly optimistic. It is that true change occurs when leaders are willing to let the stream of history run its natural course. But leaders strong enough, like President Bush, to resist the urge to speed history along are sadly rare, especially when intoxicated by the power at their disposal. It is far easier, you see, to deploy jealousy, nationalism, violence, and yes, the forces of history, to mold a past that, even if not particularly accurate, is at least particularly useful. Ultimately, then, how one understands the fall of the wall, how one understands 1989's true meaning, depends. As Deng Xiaoping told his inner circle right before ordering the crackdown at Tiananmen, quote, "We are not afraid to shed a little blood. You carry these things out, and the Westerners forget." End quote. When considering the Berlin Wall in its long historic context, I think that Deng at this point was only part right. The world, you see, does not forget. It simply remembers what it wants. Thank you. Andrew, I believe you want me to take some questions, or abuse, as it were. Any questions? Sir.
Dr. Engel, great speech. And regarding your point about President Bush not wanting to declare the Cold War over in July 1990, I remember, I can't be sure of the date, but I believe it was September 9th, 1990, when he met with Mikhail Gorbachev in Europe. He said at the beginning of the meeting, and this quote I'm sure of in the archives, that he wanted that meeting, the message to go out that they were closing the book on the Cold War. He wanted to close the book on the Cold War. So In fact, he envisioned a cartoon in a major American newspaper the next day, visualizing the closing of the book, the two of them. So what changed between, say, July and August and the fall and only a couple months later, based on your research?
One thing and one thing only, which is Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, and the Americans realized they needed Soviet support, not only Soviet moral support, but more importantly, no Soviet veto in the Security Council. James Baker actually also refers to this as a moment when, standing side by side with Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, both of them condemning the Iraqis, remembering, of course, that Iraq had for a long time been a Soviet client state, he argues that this was a moment that he realized that the Cold War was over. And in fact, if you play out the story further, one of the interesting codas to this story is that Gorbachev actually becomes a little bit of a, how do you want me to put it, sir? Well, I'm Jewish, so I can say it in Yiddish. A pain in the tuchus. Because he at the last moment decides that he's going to win peace in Iraq literally hours before the Americans are about to launch Operation Desert Storm. And this causes the Americans no sense of frustration. And in fact, there's a wonderful quote by President Bush. Actually, there's two wonderful quotes in the conversation. We have the full, of course, memorandum of conversation between President Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev at this time. And you have to remember that it's usually very hard to determine tone of voice or intonation from a memory of conversation. It's just words on a page. In this case, we happen to know what the tone of President Bush's remarks were, because about halfway through, Mikhail Gorbachev begins to say, "George, calm down. George, stop yelling. George, calm down."
Telephone conversation? Yes, I think I remember him saying, "Be cool," or at least that's how it's translated, which makes it even sound better.
Well, he was always cool.
Right, but...
So the other part of the conversation that's really important is when President Bush says to Mikhail Gorbachev, "Don't let us fall out over Saddam. There are bigger things at stake than Saddam." The post-Cold War order was at stake, was what he was saying. And consequently, the Cold War was over, but Gorbachev could still screw it up at that moment. And now Gorbachev, at that point, to his great credit, and I can't recall the exact quote, so you'll have to wildly paraphrase, Gorbachev essentially says, "You know, that's a good point." And that's when he stops. Other thoughts? Questions? Other examples of President Bush yelling at people? So, there are very few, actually. So, sir.
Again, thank you, sir, for this great speech. I guess the question I have is, we look towards the future with more global terrorism. We have, I guess, Putin rising in Russia. We still have ISIS now. What can we take away from the Berlin Wall, where terrorism kind of always existed during the Cold War, but was pushed to the back because of the Cold War? Is it Putin's aggression being pushed back a little bit because of ISIS and other issues going on with Iraq?
I understood the first part of the question. I'm not sure I understand the second. Can you tell me the second part again about Putin's being pushed
sure.
back?
Sure. Yeah. I guess with issues going on with the Ukraine and issues going on with Iraq, is it kind of a mix where, I guess in a sense, a reverse, where before terrorism was kind of pushed back during the Cold War, and now I guess Putin and Russian aggression is being pushed back because of ISIS, or as it seems to be perpetrated in the media?
I think it's useful to look at this in the broadest historical of terms. And when we say, which I think is completely accurate, that terrorism was largely subdued during the period of the Cold War, and we have the image, therefore, of the great powers, the Soviets and the Americans in particular, stamping down on terrorism, we have to remember that's only transnational terrorism. People of Vietnam, for example, would tell you there was a lot of terrorism going on. People of Hungary would tell you there's a lot of terrorism going on. But those were all internal, inside of borders. I think we have to remember that that's actually somewhat the anomaly, historically, that individuals fighting with violence for their own vision of the future is actually more common than not. And so it does make one bizarrely wistful for the Cold War, because at the very least, we had the threat of thermonuclear annihilation, which isn't great. But at least we understood and hoped that we could trust the person on the other end of the button. That's not clearly as clear right now. And so I think that that's the first concern. The other thing about Putin, which I find really fascinating, and I alluded to it in my talk, is that he seems absolutely determined to be a very successful 19th century autocrat. He wants all the old-fashioned things. You know, he wants land, he wants oil, yes, he wants access to water, wants to sort of run up his flag. And my sense is that the rest of the world in the 21st century is basically saying, you know, you can win the 19th century, the bond markets will take care of you. And we'll get back to you in 20 years when you come to your senses. So I'm actually less concerned about Putin in the long run as a consequence, especially now that I'm paying so little for my gas. Well, I guess that's it. Well, if you wouldn't mind, before I'm under instruction to say, let us also give one more thanks to President Bush on this historic evening, and also allow the President and Mrs. Bush to exit the auditorium. So thank you all.
Please join us outside for the reception. And thanks for coming this evening.